Hi, I'm Cassie McCullough and welcome to The List, RN's weekly intelligence briefing on popular culture operations around the world.
And I'm Jason DeRosso, and today a look back at the year in which social media consolidated its place in our hearts and minds, and in news, advertising, television, music, fashion, just about every corner of life.
We'll take a look at some of the milestones of the year that revealed just how rapidly it's changing what we do and how we do it.
That's coming up on The List.
Well, first to the passing of the great Nelson Mandela, which, while not a surprise, is certainly a profound moment, an historic one. It's hard to imagine what the world would have been like without him and without the changes that have occurred because of him.
Yes, his influence was enormous, impossible to quantify, and obviously we'll be hearing a lot more about that influence and legacy in coming days and weeks. But it has to be said that Mandela also had a huge influence on popular culture, not least of which was film, the big screen. Currently, there is a new film called Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom, which is already screened in the US. The Obamas had a special White House screening for it. Releases here next February. Now, there's a lot of Oscar buzz around this film, and in particular, around the performance of Idris Elba as Mandela.
He's fantastic. He's the guy who played Stringer Bell in The Wire, and more recently, Luther in the BBC series.
Yeah, absolutely. Great actor. Let's have a taste of that.
The accused are responsible for acts of sabotage with the intention of overthrowing the government.
Nelson Mandela, do you plead guilty or not guilty?
My lord, it is not I but the government that should plead guilty. Freedom, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
Yes, of course, and a couple of years ago, there was the Clint Eastwood film Invictus, which starred Morgan Freeman. But it's not just film where Mandela has been an icon. If you've been listening to RN today, you will have already heard Robbie Buck play the Specials song, Free Nelson Mandela. And if you're listening to us on Sunday morning, it's likely you will have heard it a few more times since then. Robbie Buck is with us now. We've detained him for a couple of minutes. G'day, Robbie.
Hi, Robbie.
Hello. Now, you've already played a couple of tracks on the Inside Sleeve today.
Yeah, Nelson Mandela, of course, over the course of his life, inspired so much music. A lot of musicians in South Africa, but I think even more musicians outside of the country, particularly in the late 70s and 80s, who were brought to the to the plight of him, but also the apartheid issue in South Africa. And so many prominent musicians wrote songs about apartheid, and in particular about Nelson Mandela. There was heaps of them. Bono and Joe Strummer did a song together called 4664, which of course relates to the number, his prison number when he was in prison. Carlos Santana and Wayne Shorter did a song simply called Mandela as well back in about 1987. There were, you may recall, back in about 1988, a whole range of concerts that coincided with Mandela's 70th birthday, I think, from memory. The one that I played earlier on today, which is, I guess, one of the most identifiable songs when it comes to Nelson Mandela, is The Specials, or The Specials AKA, and this song.
What's so wonderful about that is it's so up, but it still has that sense of yearning in it and that great, you know, angst.
Absolutely. I mean, it moves away from the morbid. There are other artists like Peter Gabriel, for example, did a song not about Mandela, but about Biko, another central figure in the apartheid struggle. And that one, obviously, not a celebration. It's a commemoration of a man's life that's been ended because of apartheid. This one, though, has that uplifting sense of, you betcha, free him. Get him out of there. I mean, what are you doing?
Yeah. And I wonder how much influence that songs like that and other popular culture artifacts had.
It's impossible to quantify, isn't it? But they must have had a huge just raising the awareness at the time because they were all over the place.
Yeah. I remember the regime, I guess, the apartheid government back then claiming that the song written by Stephen Van Zandt about not playing Sun City, which was a resort in South Africa at the time, time had no effect because, well, we'd never invited Van Zandt to play here in the first place. So how can he say he's not playing?
But that's not true at all, because there were a lot of other bands. I mean, I think Queen, for example, had played at Sun City close to that out, to that recording coming out. And I know that there were a lot of other musicians from America and the UK who changed their minds about playing at a resort like that because of that public awareness.
We've got a little clip of that.
Was that Lou Reed?
That Lou Reed was in there, Bonnie Raitt, Reuben Blades and John Oates as well.
Oh, an incredible range of people. I think Herbie Hancock was in there, Run DMC. Extraordinary, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, Steve Van Zandt, as we know, from the Springsteen band.
And the Sopranos.
and the Sopranos.
Yeah.
Well, we should say that not all the tributes to Mandela have been great. And, of course, Nickelback's If Everyone Cared was probably one that we won't remember today. It was devoted to a whole bunch of activists, including Mandela, but Bob Geldof and Betty Williams, etc.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Nickelback doesn't quite stand up in the company that we've been mentioning so far today, I'm afraid.
They did give all proceeds to Amnesty International.
Oh, thank goodness for that.
Well, Robbie, there's plenty more music that we haven't even talked about today, but thanks for taking us on this brief trip down memory lane.
Our pleasure. Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Cassie.
Yeah, thanks. On RN, this is The List, your weekly roundup of popular culture. I'm Cassie McCullough, and with me is co-host Jason DeRosso.
2013 will go down in history books as the year that social media tightened its stranglehold on the world. From stock market floats to deals with TV networks, these days, everywhere you look, you can see its tentacles infiltrating further into the daily business of life. And increasingly, the swirling eddies and currents of opinion, news and debate that is the social media landscape is where we go to inform ourselves about the world, maybe even before we turn on the television, radio or pick up a newspaper. So today we take stock at how social media has developed in the last 12 months with two guests who spend a lot of time crunching numbers and thinking up strategies for social media. Leslie Nassar is a technology strategy consultant. He's the tech guy behind ABC One's Q&A Twitter feed, for example. G'day, Leslie.
Hi, Leslie.
Hey, Jason.
And Kim McKay is director of Click Communications, a company that specialises in public relations and social media. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Great to have you.
Leslie, first to you, what's different in the social media landscape compared to 12 months ago?
Actually, as you mentioned earlier, there's been a massive amount of consolidation, particularly with Twitter rather than Facebook. So Twitter has spent about $700 million acquiring companies in its lifetime. It spent $600 million of that in the last 12 months.
And what kind of companies are these? Are they ones that threaten it or enhance what they offer?
For the most part, they enhance what they offer. So the bulk of that $600 million has probably gone to purchasing analytics companies, so companies who are very good with crunching data, so obviously for advertising purposes.
Right, so that's how they're going to monetize the main business of Twitter.
Exactly. So one of the things that advertisers really want is they want to know that the money they're spending advertising is going to the right places, or it's going to people who are receptive. So one of the things that making these big data, what they call big data acquisitions, is it allows them to really finely segment up the Twitter audience so that advertisers get the most bang for their buck.
Kim, what stood out for you in terms of the major events in the social media business over the last 12 months?
I think exactly what sort of Leslie was saying, but I think it's fueled by this sort of codependency of the user, social and mobile going together. So quite often they're buying things, they're understanding that consumer behaviour has changed in social, and that's informed their acquisition kind of strategies.
So what for the average person like me using social media, what's the difference that I will have seen?
You will have seen the advertising coming to you because you're using it on mobile now, using social and mobile a lot more than you are on desktop. The advertising you're being fed is in that context. Because your mobile knows where you are because of your GPS coordinates, you're getting advertising different to everybody else based on the content you've been interested in before and where you might be standing at that moment.
How effective has this been with users? And you know, what's the turnoff factor here with these developments over the last 12 months? Because I know just anecdotally, a lot of my friends are getting really annoyed with this kind of integration of advertising in things like Twitter feeds.
I can see the annoyance, but I'd also argue that you don't see half of the advertising that's now being filtered to you. So I would sort of say it's been hugely successful for advertisers and for the platforms.
Yeah, look, I think, Jason, one of the things that we've seen Twitter in particular doing it differently is that they've been focusing on having more compelling content. So even though it's still advertising, it's still content that's coming from a specific partner, it's at least relevant to your interests. It's not going to be, hey, buy this toothbrush. It's going to be, hey, you've been reading tweets about this amazing basketball shot. Here's the actual vision of that basketball shot, which then links through to additional content.
What about in terms of the user demographics? I mean, where are users heading now in terms of the different social media platforms and even in terms of the emerging social media platforms?
One of the things that we've noticed is that the age of users for social media is going up, right? It's going up and up and up.
You mean getting older?
Getting older, wow. I should say.
Okay, yeah.
So the age of social media users is going up and people are getting older. But we're not seeing younger audiences come into those established social networks. They're going more towards the Snapchats of the world rather than the Facebooks.
Well, what are younger people looking for when they're going to places like Snapchat, for example? Let's take that as an example. What is Snapchat, first of all, and why is it attracting younger people?
Yep, so Snapchat is a way of sharing content, sharing photos or sharing whatever, in a way that's going to self-destruct, right? So if I send you a photo of my dog, I know that that photo of my dog is not going to stick around on someone's servers forever, or it's not going to stick around on your phone necessarily.
It's not going to leave a trail, unless, in theory.
Unless you know the workarounds, yeah, that's right. pretty straightforward.
That's right, unless you know how to take a screenshot. But it is much more of a private platform. It's not that sort of oversharing that we see Facebook leading towards.
You choose who you send it to. It's destroyed, so there's no trace of it, which is almost the complete philosophical opposite of Facebook, which is anything you put on there is kind of broadcast to people you may not even know if you haven't got your settings right, and then it's there for all time to be monetized by Facebook somewhere down the track. It's interesting then that Facebook did make a move to buy Snapchat that was rebuffed by its young owners this year.
Yeah, I don't know why Snapchat would have turned down that much money, right? I think that what we'll end up seeing is
about $3 billion.
Just an insane amount of money, right? And if the reports are true, then they are nuts, right? Because Snapchat is a very temporary platform. It's something that's easily clonable by anyone else. The younger social media audiences are quite fickle. You know, ask anyone who used to work for MySpace or any of the other social networks that have fallen to the side over the years. You've got to take those opportunities as they come. You know, why would Facebook have made an offer that big to someone like a Snapchat? And I think that it comes back to the demographic. It comes back to that younger audience. It comes to a way of almost buying your way back into that youth market.
Kim, in terms of the appeal of Snapchat to younger people and where we're seeing newer users on social media gravitate to, what are the key concerns? Is it that they're wanting to reclaim some kind of privacy or some kind of exclusivity?
That's exactly what it is. So quite often kids are now friends, in inverted commas, with their parents on Facebook. So it's increasingly important for them to have a vehicle that they feel they can talk directly just to their friends. And this, we call it sort of the closed user group. They're more comfortable there. They've kind of deluded themselves to think that content won't be around forever, although we know, you know, it will be. So there's that. I think in the rest of the social media landscape, though, everything's settled down and the bigger players and the bigger platforms have found their purpose. So Facebook's for one thing, Pinterest is clearly for another, as is Instagram, and consumers have really understood what each is for.
What are the differences? What are they all for?
Facebook is really about your everyday. It's your dog, your cat, your kid, your cup of coffee. Pinterest is where you go to dream and have this kind of aspirational life. And Instagram is of that moment, the beauty that you're seeing in life. And I think it took a while, but 2013 for me was the year when everyone sort of figured that out. And they've figured out where they're comfortable and where they want to play. And brands have done the same, followed suit.
Well, that's what you do. Help brands find a strategy that works for them on social media. How do you navigate all those different outlets?
I think it's by just following suit. I mean, brands do not lead the way. They have lost control of the conversation around their brand. I think the sooner they realise that and embrace that, the better off they'll be. The consumers will tell us how they want to use a platform. If we engage with them in a way they want to, in a time they want to, with information and content that's important and relevant, brands will win.
How do you get into those?
Not win, but doing that.
But how do you get into those closed sort of networks that are developing?
That's the scary bit. That is the really scary bit. So Domino's did something on Snapchat this week. I haven't had a chance to look at the results.
This was the pizza chain.
Yeah. I'm sure they just would have got flooded with a lot of sort of geeks like us, dare I say it, just kind of trying to troll the system and see how serious they were. But I think that's the scary bit for marketers, I'll be honest. How do we get in a meaningful way without busting in? Because it's rude to bust into a private conversation.
Mm. So what did Domino's do?
They asked for you to Snapchat a picture of a pizza or a box of a pizza or something.
I can see all the possibilities
for trying, but
going
I just
wrong.
I don't think.
Yes.
Yeah.
How did it go? Do we know?
As I said, I haven't had a chance to look at the results yet, but I'm going in skeptically.
Let's talk about the other sort of content that floats around in social media and goes viral and is so important too, and that's kind of news-based content or users engaging in an unfolding debate. Let's put it that way. What were the big events this year which unfolded first and foremost on social media? Leslie?
Well, this morning you had the death of Nelson Mandela. So he passed and Twitter immediately exploded. So I happened to be tracking the traffic around Nelson Mandela at the time, in the half an hour leading up to it and then right afterwards. And it was amazing, just the way that that Twitter transformed in a period of 2 or 3 minutes. So right after the announcement was made, you got the reactions coming through where CNN was being retweeted thousands of times per minute. It was an extraordinary sight to see.
It was, actually. I was on Twitter. I knew already about the passing of Nelson Mandela, and I was looking for some other news, and it was impossible to find. It was only news about it.
Kim, how does news unfolding on social media differ from news unfolding in old media on the television or you know, radio newspapers and so forth? How do we interact with the news differently in social media?
I think there's that immediacy. So traditionally radio was the only platform that got to us that quickly as social media. And Twitter, in my mind, has gone from a social network to a news network. So while we don't wait till 6 o'clock now to catch the news, we're seeing it as it happened. And you almost sort of turn on the news at night and you think, are they still talking about that? You know, it's been 8 hours. So there's a real shift with consumers that they want to see it as it happens, understand it, be able to ask questions.
Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it? Now, we did talk about changes in where the youth social media audience is going. But you also mentioned that the age is increasing in social media. What is that going to do to platforms such as Facebook as the audience gets older?
I think we're seeing that shakeout just now, as we sort of mentioned. So people are going to have many memories on Facebook. So my children, should I have any, will see my life on Facebook, understand where I met my husband, where we sort of went on dates. They will almost have this entire archive of our lives. So I think as the generations go through, the family memories will be online, as crazy as that sounds.
Mm, a repository of social history, Leslie Nasser?
It is, and it's quite a terrifying prospect, really. It's the idea that that my daughters are going to see the kind of ridiculous nonsense I got up to when I was younger. It scares me, you know. It's but that's the reality now, and there's no getting past it.
With the two IPOs of the two big major social media platforms, Twitter and Facebook, of course, I'm talking about by IPO, the floating of both companies on the stock market. Which was more successful? Facebook, of course, happened in 2012, but, you know, the consequences rolled on into this year. Twitter was this year. How do we judge which was more successful?
I don't think we can really say that one was more successful than the other. We can look at it from a purely numbers perspective and say, well, who's got the biggest market cap right now? And it's going to be Facebook. Facebook is worth more on paper than Twitter is. But does that make them more successful? Well, not necessarily, because unless the company is growing, unless they're bringing in more revenue, then they're not by any definition a successful company. I look at what's happened post-IPO for both Facebook and Twitter, you see some really interesting acquisitions coming out of both companies, but Twitter, flush with IPO money, seems to be doing more things with it, or seem to be moving in directions that they've wanted to go in but haven't had the money to be able to do it.
Kim McKay.
I think what's really interesting is this, the war of content almost, because we do interact so much on social while watching television. Facebook and Twitter seem to be doing deals. I believe Twitter's done a deal with Southern Cross and Tend here in Australia. They'll then have exclusive rights to kind of farm out some of that content, winning the eyeballs.
How will it work?
They will have, so if, whether it's new MasterChef or Biggest Loser, if they've done a deal with Tend, they will be able to kind of seed that content. So we're more likely to be on Twitter for those programs rather than Facebook.
Uh-huh. Well, what about some of the defining moments of the last 12 months on social media? Something that's really illustrated to you a change in the way that we understand social media and the way we use it. First to you, Leslie Nasser.
I think it'd be self-serving of me to use one of my own projects as an example, but I will anyway. And that was with, we'd had a rugby tour come through Australia. The Lions came through and we integrated Twitter with a live TV broadcast. And that's beyond just putting a ticker at the bottom of the screen with some tweets on it. We actually had a whole separate app being built that showed you the live stream of all of the social media activity happening while you watch TV. And if you wanted to turn the volume down on the TV, you could listen to an alternate commentary through the app as well. So we had Roy and HG record an alternate commentary to the game that was in play. So what you had in the living room then was more than just a TV, which everyone sat around and they watched that one piece of vision. That was the biggest thing for me in social this year, was just that revelation that we could go so much further than we've been until now.
What about you, Kim McKay?
For me, I think it was really just around bushfires and the election, which I think, you know, it's Twitter, and it's not just us following the news, it's us making, participating, joining the news conversation, which has been happening, but the broader community, everyday consumers are now firing that kind of news funnel, and I find that tremendously exciting.
It's extraordinary the way it's now become a communication tool of choice for the emergency services. I mean, that's a really highly risky thing to do.
It is.
And it proves that they trust it.
I think it demonstrates that difference between communication and conversation. So I can communicate something to you, I tell you something, but if we have a conversation, we'll probably both leave with a different kind of understanding or shared meaning. That's what's happening on social, because we're all being involved in a conversation.
What about you, Jason DeRosso?
For me, it was the spill earlier this year, because it wasn't happening when I went to see a film for work, went to see a preview, came out of the film, opened up the smartphone, and it was on. And it was, I can't even remember what the film was that I saw, but I remember that walk home from the cinema, that 20-minute walk home, and just, you know, not really looking where I was going, just following the spill and following what was happening on my phone. And I thought, wow, this is where we're at now. Our heads are in completely different spaces thanks to this portable social media device that smartphones have largely become, I think.
Mm. Yeah, well, similarly for me, the moment was very recently the verdict of the Simon Gutani trial, which happened in New South Wales and perhaps wasn't followed as much around the country, but he was eventually found guilty of murdering his girlfriend, Lisa Harnham. But it was Justice Lucy McCallum's close to 5-hour verdict that was absolutely gripping. And for the first time for me, I was following the verdict of a judge in a courtroom that I would have, you know, would like to have been there. I couldn't because of all kinds of circumstances, but I was able to follow it in detail from my workplace. And I think it's a real watershed moment, for the legal system, naturally. I mean, it's fraught with all kinds of problems. The people who were tweeting from there were extraordinarily skilled court reporters. It's a highly risky thing to be doing. They did it fantastically. They did a great job right across all the different media outlets. It's something I think that we probably will see develop, because it's not going to be the same in all states and territories. The different courts will have different rules about what can be done. But I just think it's a great way of having us in the courtroom without sending out audio or vision, which turns it into a circus. I think it's a way that keeps it within the court reporting practice very tightly. But it will be interesting to see how that develops. But that was one for me this year. And remember that for the latest in technology and social media and consumer electronics and digital culture and much, much more, Radio National's Mark Fennell untangles your wired world on Download This Show. That's Sundays at 9 p.m. and, of course, you can always download it.
All right, now it's time to discuss our obsessions this week. What have we been obsessing about? What can we not get out of our heads? First to you, Leslie Nassar.
My wife and children are in the US at the moment, so my obsession has been ridiculously violent video games. I've been playing too many of them, and I think the sort of a sub-obsession has been making breakfast burritos. But video games have been my obsession this week. It's
has it changed your behaviour? Have you found yourself walking down the street thinking bad things?
No more than usual.
This is my dream, by the way. Yeah, the empty house and just embarking on the video game marathon. It is so hard to find, carve out the time. But anyway, can I ask you what games?
I'm playing a lot of Battlefield at the moment.
Okay. People will know what that means out there, and if they don't, well, it, you know, you can get a hint of from the title, right. I guess, what it would entail.
I think of it as being a military murder simulator.
Okay, on that note, Kim,
I don't think I've ever felt so vanilla. My obsession is a website called Canva that is teaching me to be a graphic designer. It's giving me all the tools and it's making all of my stuff look beautiful. And everything we do now is visual. If you think of all the content people are engaging in, it's what it looks like rather than what it says. So I've always kind of never had a great design eye. So I'm obsessed with playing with Canva. It's an Australian startup that's raised about $3 million recently.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'm obsessed. I'm doing such great things on it.
Wow. Mm. Okay, well, we'll definitely put a link to that on our website.
To you, Cassie McCullough.
Look, just briefly, we are now out of TV ratings season, so I've got stockpiled a whole bunch of stuff ready to watch, one of which is what I think was the sleeper hit for me of the last part of the year, which is Sleepy Hollow, which is the most stupid retelling of the Headless Horseman story. But as I've been watching it, I mean, the characters, the cast are really engaging. They're quite lovely. But I realised it's sort of like a version of fan fiction of history. It's just really quite stupid. Of course, the network has put it late at night, so it didn't take off. But in the US, it's been a massive hit and it's already signed up for another season. So, you know, there's your summer guilty pleasure, Sleepy Hollow.
And a little bit macabre there, like my obsession also, because I've come across this really interesting article titled How Radioactive Poison Became the Assassin's Weapon of Choice. But it's this long article explaining the mysterious life and brutal death of Alexander Litvinenko, and, you know, who was killed via radioactive substances. And it's blood-curdling, yeah. Cassie, you will know I have a pretty weak stomach for this kind of thing, but I am drawn to all things bizarre and medical. And, this story, which appeared in the online journal Matter, has it all, really. So we'll put a link up on our website to that one. All right, well, it's time to go and say thank you, first of all, to our two guests today, Leslie Nassar and Kim McKay. Thanks to the both of you.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Kim McKay is Director of Click Communications, a company that specialises in public relations and social media. And Leslie Nassar is a tech strategy consultant. He's the guy behind that compelling ABC One Q&A Twitter feed. Well, it's time to go now on the list. Remember, you can check out the webpage for links to all sorts of interesting stuff we put up each week. You might like to leave a comment as well. I'm Jason DeRosso.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. See you next week.